Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
This just in, hot off the bench press. Planet Fitness has added new strength equipment. Save $28 or more when you join today, and you can be one of the first to try it out. We're raising the bar with new benches, and our new hack squat will have you actually looking forward to leg day. Plus, we're still repping all of the best-in-class equipment we've always had, with most clubs open 24 hours, so you can work out your way on your time. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 10th. See home club for details.
This is Too Many Minutes, a One Heat Minute Productions podcast miniseries cracking the code of Phil Alden Robinson's 1992 tech caper, Sneakers. To decode this evergreen, era-bridging, infinitely rewatchable masterpiece, we're splitting the film into its component parts, much like its multi-generational ensemble cast for the ages. Since seeing Sneakers in cinemas all the way back in 1992, I've been trying to deconstruct the alchemy. Why does every single element harmonize so perfectly? Is it the score, the compositions, the performances, the script, the setting, the subject, the actors? After 32 years, I finally cracked it. I found Janus's little black box.
Don't look, listen.
The addition of each new cast member, each new voice, each new tone, what's on the page doesn't just bring them together, rather it becomes the framework to support what all these actors mean then and mean now to movie lovers across the decades. Phil Adam Robinson becomes a music producer as much as a director, remixing and sampling these performances, turning up the volume on their very specific music. This is a supergroup, so let's dig in and see how each bar, each sample, makes Sneakers a best of album at the jump. In episode 5, you're going to hear from author, screenwriter, and podcaster, Lee Zachariah. You're going to hear from writer and film essayist, Priscilla Page. And for the first time so far in the series, you're going to hear from film critic, historian, author, and podcaster, Jason Bailey. And finally, you're going to hear from the co-writer and director of Sneakers, Phil Alden Robinson. This episode is part of the same system that NASA used when they faked the Apollo moon landings. So it worked for them. Shouldn't give us too many problems. What you're going to hear coming up is a lengthy discussion about the career of Dan Aykroyd through the great film historian Jason Bailey and I. Along the way, we're going to talk to Lee Zachariah, who contributes with questions about the film's ending and how potentially alienating it is for viewers. Priscilla Page joins the ranks to discuss the fork in the road moment in casting where Dan Aykroyd asked Phil Alden Robinson if he could play Cosmo. But Academy Award winner Ben Kingsley had already been earmarked for that role. And then the great co-writer and director of Sneakers, Phil Alden Robinson, comes back to talk about working with Kingsley as Cosmo and how he sees that character fitting in to the overarching story of Sneakers. To start, though, let's think about the literal and metaphorical music that Dan Aykroyd brings to a picture like this. The perfect comedic harmony. And well, if I say he's the perfect comedic harmony, you of course think of Elwood Blues. So, let's go back to Sweet Home Chicago.
Same old place, sweet home, Chicago.
tell me about your relationship firstly with sneakers, but then I particularly want to deep dive in on literally the man who I was most familiar with. Seeing this in 1992 in the cinema, I wasn't going wild for Sidney Poitier. I wasn't going wild for Robert Redford. I was like, oh my God, there's Ray Stantz. There's my guy, Dan Aykroyd. And so can you tell me about your first experience, and then let's dive into the kind of weird and wonderful career of Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah. So I did see this during the original theatrical release. I was excited about it, not even because of any of the players who were all like, I did like a lot of those folks, including Mr. Aykroyd. But because it was Phil Alden Robinson's follow-up to Field of Dreams. And God, I loved Field of Dreams. Like, you know, that I was kind of like just the right age when Field of Dreams came out. I was 13.
Yeah.
Went to see it in the theater with my dad, you know. Got to see my dad cry at a movie, which is like imprints. It makes a powerful impression. And so when this came out, we were like, oh, this looks pretty good. And then, you know, my dad did like, he wasn't a cinephile per se, but he did like movies and he did pay attention to things. And when the first reviews came out, he was like, oh, we should go see this. This is the Field of Dreams guy. So we went, and, I didn't really know heist movies yet.
Yes.
You know what I mean? I think maybe like Muppet Caper, and that was about it. You know?
That's absolutely a foundational heist text, some may say.
It is. It's very much, you know, the ground level work of being a heist movie connoisseur. And now, like, really and truly, heist movies are among my three or four favorite kinds of movies.
Yeah.
But at that time, I was still sort of, you know, so I was dazzled by all of that stuff more than anything else on that first viewing, just like the intricacies of the operation.
Yes.
You know, and how they figure out how they're going to break in, how they execute the plan, how the plan is clarified for the viewer. And then you understand when things go sideways, like all of this, which is very, you know, it's the boxes that you check for a heist movie. But I, you know, was not terribly well versed in them at the time, so I found all of that just thrilling.
Yes.
You know, and I found it funny, and I enjoyed the ensemble. But I much like you, I was at least partially there for Dan, for Mr. Aykroyd. Because I was a Ghostbusters kid, like I am very much of the Ghostbusters generation. Again, you know, I feel like you, with these formative movies, you have to preface it with, I was this age when it came out. I was 8 years old when the original Ghostbusters came out, like that summer when I saw it, you know, two, three times, once at the drive-in. And I will also say, and I feel like you have to put this footnote in, my love of Ghostbusters lasted for like about 5 years. Like it does not define me. It has no relevance to my current personality. I'm not concerned with what's become of that universe. Like the day that my Ghostbusters fandom died was in the summer of 89 when I went to see Ghostbusters 2. And I was like, well, this is a piece of shit. And that was kind of that. But, you know, I did love that movie. It represents a lot of, I'm not saying anything new here about what was sort of great about 80s movie comedy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the special effects heavy comedy, which is a thing that really feels like it's sort of gone by the wayside. Like every, you know, smart ass kid of a certain age, I wanted to be Bill Murray in that movie.
Of course.
Like, I love all of that stuff. And, you know, and I think what's interesting to look at in terms of those two stars is the way that each of them carried out the career in the years following Ghostbusters.
Yes.
That Bill Murray got super fucking selective.
Yes.
You know, like, first of all, had like made Ghostbusters primarily as a chip to cash at Columbia so he could make his Razor's Edge, his passion project of his film adaptation of The Razor's Edge, inexplicably enough. And then like disappeared for 2 years, does the cameo in Little Shop, disappears for a couple of more years, you know, and then comes back in 88 for Scrooged and then Ghostbusters 2 after that. Like he very much took it easy after the success of Ghostbusters. And Dan Aykroyd just like worked nonstop.
Yes.
He had always been a prolific actor, writer, etc. Continued on both of those tracks very steadily in the years afterwards. And I don't want to be disrespectful about this because I do admire the man and his work. But he really, a lot of this just feels like working to work, you know? I mean, when you look over
There's a corridor between like 80, there's a corridor between like almost 80 to like 95 that although there's a lot of great movies in that corridor. And then there's a whole bunch of random stuff after that that doesn't seem and you know in sort of bits and bobs you see him pop up in like interesting more interesting choices. You might go like 2001, he just pops up in Pearl Harbor and you're like, oh, Dan Aykroyd's in Pearl Harbor, that's cool, like that's a cool little thing. But there are, it is a weird, you know, 51st Dates later you're like, oh cool, Dan Aykroyd, but it's not there's no, in his filmography, unlike Bill Murray, there's no like Lost in Translation
Where you
go,
yeah,
holy hell, or like a Rushmore, for example. Like you don't, you don't go, Jesus Christ, this is something so great that I never knew I wanted from this person. It's a is an odd one.
It's a strange career, and like the, you know, and even that, even in that 80s corridor that you're talking about, there are, you know, there are legit classics in there, you know.
Yes.
The aforementioned Ghostbusters, obviously, you know, Blues Brothers, Trading Places. But, you know, even in amongst those, there are big, loud failures. You know, like I know I have a sort of a peculiar admiration for Neighbors with him and Belushi. But I mean, that was a huge flop at the time.
Yeah.
Dr. Detroit, you know, same thing. Spies Like Us, like, was supposed to be a big hit because it was him and Chevy and John Landis, and it's not great. I do like Dragnet. The Couch Trip does not have a lot of fans, nor does The Great Outdoors. Caddyshack 2, the less said, the better.
Yes.
My Stepmother is an Alien. I mean, like, these are not great
movies. My Stepmother
is
an Alien is such a, is a real attempt at doing a special effects comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now got a weird cult following. We actually watched it a lot of, as a kid on VHS, but it's also patently bad.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you've ever had the misfortune of sitting through Loose Cannons with him and Gene Hackman in a buddy cop movie, but I can't recommend that experience. And then really in 91, so this is important. This is a key hinge
this
in the career.
Big one. Big one.
The year before Sneakers, we have sort of the nadir of Dan Aykroyd as a filmmaker, because he had written some of these pictures. You know, Dragnet was a script. You know, Blues Brothers, obviously, he co-wrote. Ghostbusters, obviously, he co-wrote. Some of the lesser ones as well. In 1991, he writes, directs, and co-stars in Nothing But Trouble.
A VHS curio classic in the Howard House, because Dan Aykroyd was one of our guys and we watched it, and I
mean,
I've never had a more bewildering experience in my life.
How
Jason.
Could a movie with Chevy, Dan Aykroyd, and John Candy not be great? That must be a hilarious, funny, terrific comedy.
It's one of the most bizarre movies I think ever made.
It's inexplicable. It's utterly inexplicable. I saw it during its very brief theatrical run in 1991. Mm. Was very excited about it at the time because, hey, it's Dan Aykroyd's, you know, directorial debut. Ended up being his directorial finish as well. It's the only movie he directed. And I just sort of sat there in slack-jawed bewilderment. And then I revisited Nothing But Trouble about a year and a half ago because I was working on an aborted biographical book about John Candy. And before that book was abandoned, I had completed all of the rewatching and watching, which really did mean that I had to suffer through quite a number of very bad John Candy movies, and Nothing But Trouble is very much amongst them.
But just really, I want to take one aside there is,
yeah,
John Candy, on the other hand, like Bill Murray, had these mm-hmm. wonderful, like JFK turns
mm-hmm.
where,
yeah,
huge comedic performer, obviously could charm the pants off of anything. And then he goes and does JFK and he's just magnificent in 10 minutes of that movie. Like, I feel like John Candy, may he rest in peace, would have had a lot more of that Bill Murray-esque career trajectory later in his selective nature of the way that he sort of started to approach his career rather than Aykroyd. And so it is a weird like nexus there because I think that Chevy and Aykroyd have felt more familiar and similar in their trajectory of careers versus the Murrays and the John Candys on the other side.
Yeah. The key difference being that people don't appear to hate Dan Aykroyd. That would be sort of the difference between where him and Chevy have gone. But then the other sort of key moment that we're looking at when we're sort of analyzing the Aykroyd career at this moment is that in 1989, Aykroyd co-stars in Driving Miss Daisy.
Yes.
He's playing a serious supporting role in a drama.
Yeah.
And is nominated for an Academy Award, his first and only Academy Award nomination, Best Actor in a Supporting Role for Driving Miss Daisy. And so, you know, this is this moment where it's like, okay, within a couple of years, we have the sort of total flame out of him as a creator of big screen comedies, but then this sort of other track of the supporting player, the character actor.
Yes.
That mode is being opened up to him. That mode is being opened up to him. And so I think when you look then at the 90s for Aykroyd, which again, he's just working furiously.
Yes.
You know, there is no break in there. And he's sort of, you know, he pieces together this Blues Brothers 2000, which is a big old piece of shit. He does Celtic Pride with, you know, Daniel Cert and Damon Wayans, like, you know, a sort of attempt at sort of a high concept comedy, things like that. But then he's also doing some pretty stellar supporting performances in movies that other people have made.
Yes.
Now, you know, there are some examples to the contrary of this, you know. I'm sorry, in Coneheads. Sorry, yeah, Coneheads is a good example of
Coneheads
him also.
Is a good one. Yes.
Is Tim trying to sort of, it's much like the Blues Brothers sequel. It's like, okay, well, if I can't, you know, if Nothing But Trouble failed, then let me retreat to something that people know me for. And let me write a movie that's, you know, about one of my old characters. But so, you know, there are some bad comedies in there. But in the meantime, he's in the My Girl movies.
Yes.
In what's basically a dramatic role. He's, you know, he's pretty good in a supporting comic role in Tommy Boy. He's, I think, pretty great in a movie that basically nobody saw called Feeling Minnesota, which was very much
that
the
million,
sort of
I saw
like,
it a million years ago. Yes.
It's very much your sort of post-Tarantino, mid-90s indie thing.
Yes.
But that was part of what those movies did, was they gave, you know, sort of juicy supporting roles to actors who hadn't had a hit in a while. So he's good in that. And he's really fucking great in Gross Point Blank.
Yeah.
Like, I love what he's doing in Gross Point Blank. And so I feel like that, you know, kind of handful of performances, that's the track. He's sort of trying to work two or three different things through the 90s. He's still sort of trying to create projects, write screenplays that are starring vehicles for him, mostly based on previous successes.
Yeah.
He's still doing some of the sort of big, broad SNL style comedies, your Tommy Boys, your Sergeant Bilko's, your Celtic Prides. And then he's got this third track of the semi-serious, maybe comic, but not broadly comic supporting player.
Yeah.
And Sneakers is a really fine example. It's
the gold standard of that supporting midpoint for him. Yeah.
Squarely in that notch where he's part of this large ensemble cast, but he's not lost in this large ensemble cast. No,
he's relished. We love him in this movie.
Yes. Because, and I think partly, you know, I would love to know, and I don't know this, I will openly own it. I would love to know how much of this character as Dan Aykroyd plays him in the movie was on the page.
Yeah.
Because aside from the sort of thematic baggage of Ghostbusters, you know, because this is not, you know, this crew of misfits are not distant cousins to the Ghostbusters gang.
No.
And I would imagine that at some point when Phil Alden Robinson is in a room pitching this movie to people who write checks, he's pitching it as a Ghostbusters sort of ensemble comedy. But the more interesting thread to try to track between the character and Dan Aykroyd is how much of his own loony conspiracy theorist stuff is in that character. Now, was that there and he just was drawn to that and that was part of why he wanted to do it? Maybe. Was that there and that was part of why Phil Alden Robinson thought of him for the role? Maybe. Or maybe he really is just like riffing about the moon landing. Like, I don't know.
Life can be chaotic. If you're running a retail business, don't let disorganized order fulfillment add to the chaos. Use ShipStation instead. With ShipStation, you never have to worry about shipping and fulfillment again. Whether you're running a business out of your garage or you have multiple warehouses, ShipStation is ideal for every phase of your business's growth. Save time with one login for all your stores and by automating repetitive tasks. Plus, you'll save money with the best shipping rates from global carriers. ShipStation's industry-leading features help you deliver a better customer experience. They'll get accurate and faster shipments, along with automated tracking updates with your branding. And with up to 88% off UPS and USPS rates, and up to 90% off FedEx rates, ShipStation is the fastest and most affordable way to ship. Calm the chaos. Switch to ShipStation today. Start a free trial at ShipStation.com/audio. That's ShipStation.com/audio.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
¿Qué tal, mi gente? Te saluda Emanuel González de Mark Wahlberg Auto Group. Somos la agencia más grande de Chevrolet y GMC de todo Columbus, donde encuentras los carros y camionetas nuevos, cero millas al mejor precio. También contamos con más de 800 carros usados de todas las marcas en inventario. Te podemos aprobar con número ETIN y aceptamos identificación o pasaporte de tu país. En Mark Wahlberg te esperamos con los brazos abiertos. Visítanos hoy mismo, 3900 West Broad Street, al oeste de la ciudad, a un lado del casino. Te atendemos completamente en español. Márcanos ya, 833-699-0792.
So this is an interesting question. Does the film support Mother's conspiracy theories? Because they're kind of a running joke and it's designed to feel like a running joke. There's nothing in the plot itself about conspiracies in the traditional sense. It's all about the tech, it's about maths, it's about heists. And it's only really at the end, the news report about a seemingly unconnected pair of events, the Republican National Committee going bankrupt and the United Negro College Fund announcing record earnings. And that is maybe the cheekiest capper to a film ever, like multiple reasons. For starters, it does fuel the idea that when you hear about a conservative cause running out of money, you can blame Hollywood types hacking the mainframe. Like, that's kind of a permission to do that. They get away with it because it's so brazen. It's just so, like, it's so on the nose. But the mere idea of saying that the happy ending to this film is Republicans running out of money, you could not do that today. I'm amazed you could do it in the old time. Just the natural implication that Republicans losing money is a happy ending. I love it. And maybe they get away with it because Redford's the lead and he was Woodward and he brought down Nixon and you kind of make that calculation in your head. I don't know. That's my theory. But what I find funny about it is that there's nothing really political in the film, aside from the opening where Bishop and Cosmo are portrayed as irresponsible young college types. You can sort of write it off as that. So if you're a conservative American who's been enjoying the film up until now, you've got no reason to expect that little shiv to the gut in the closing. It comes out of nowhere.
Phil Adam Robinson had an idea for Dan to be Mother. And I think because Lasker, Phil Adam Robinson, so Lawrence Lasker, Walter Parks, who wrote the movie together, wrote the movie from San Francisco. So this emerging archetype, I've heard from some Bay Area people who have been part of the show, that this emerging archetype of like dad-aged post-Vietnam boomers who are at your parties with kids, just irresponsible, like our parents essentially, would sit around and have a few drinks and start spouting conspiracy theories. And they had like an archetype there. And I think you're so right. It's the perfect confluence of the wacky dude we now really know him to be in his bones and a character. But at the time, Phil Adam Robinson sent Dan Aykroyd the script for Mother. And Aykroyd came back and said, I want to play Cosmo.
Interesting.
He's like, I've got a really great idea of how I could do this. You know, we'll hear Phil Adam Robinson's own words about it. And he's like, Danny, I'm so sorry, but that's Ben Kingsley.
That's Academy Award winner, Ben Kingsley. Will not be Academy Award nominee, Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah, it's like in 91, like going, oh, that's going to be for Ben Kingsley. He's like, oh, okay, I gotcha.
Well, didn't he want to be Cosmo though?
He did want to be Cosmo.
He had a whole thing worked out and he was like, been hanging out with Jerry Garcia and I modeled this character on, which I don't know if I would have wanted to see personally, but maybe.
Yeah, it would have been interesting. But then he's like,
inspired.
No, we got Ben Kingsley for that. It's like, oh, okay. Gotcha. No problem. That's fine.
I get it.
It's like, yeah, I get it. Okay, cool. I'll come and play the other thing. But he's so suited to Mother. He's so suited.
It's
like
him,
it was like,
right?
Made for him. Yeah.
I mean, he claims that he was inspired by his brother, but I think he believed all those things, right?
Isn't that like that thing that you say? Is it like you say, look, I've got a friend who's got a problem? Like, that feels very much like that. It feels like that to me. I've got a friend, you know. Is your friend named Priscilla? You know, like it's like
I don't know. I just feel like those conspiracies are so, I guess maybe he's just such a good actor that it's so believable, but I'm like, this guy really believes these things, you know?
I think he is a good actor, but also like, you know, I know it's not popular to say, but it's like, if Dan Aykroyd is popping up on the Joe Rogan Experience, for example, I will listen. Cause I'm like, that's going to be 3 hours of Dan Aykroyd talking. And he's a weird guy. And
this is from like when conspiracy theories were cute, you know, fun.
It was like just heading into, and that's exactly what I was going to say. That is the experience that I've had with Aykroyd in this movie myself, is like the idea of conspiracy theories, really, like as a young person, this was the first kind of exposure that I'd had to something like a conspiracy theory. I was like, what's a conspiracy theory? Didn't really know what it was, didn't have any concept. And then like the next year is JFK. And you're like, oh, okay, conspiracy theories. Right, understood. And it's almost like that direct dialogue between those two movies, one being completely serious and this one being way more playful and fun about it. It's like, oh, this is now a guy who's on a message board. You know, this is the guy who says, do your own research. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. that's who Mother is now. But Mother was pioneering that in, you know, at this time in the 90s.
Yeah, but I don't think Aykroyd has, like, gone on to believing in... I feel like he's kept it fun. You know what I mean? Like, he's kept it really light.
He has.
He's not getting into weird shit, as far as I know. I mean... Yeah.
Paranormal weird, but not, like, conspiracy theories.
Not like, uh-oh, you know, weird.
Yeah. Not like, oh, like, do I have to unfollow this guy? I don't want to. Saying patently weird things.
He's keeping it cute with that little, like, I love his little crystal choker that he wears. Like, it's such a... I feel like that movie is so seamless. There's such attention to detail. And I think he has, like, a turquoise... It's like a bracelet or something. But, yeah, like, his jewelry is just so spot on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've heard enough stories about Dan Aykroyd's working methods that, like, okay, when he says, I have an idea for how to play Cosmo, like, that could mean anything from close to the bone to, like, Yakov Smirnoff. Like, it could be anywhere. It could be any insane idea of a weird interpretation of that character. That's great.
You know, that one of the keys to understanding Ben is that he is a creature of the theater.
Yes.
And as such, he loves nothing more than to really interact with other actors.
Yes.
Who are at his level, who can hold their own. So he loved all of that. Now, there was a night when he runs into his office and says, "You know, why is it so hot in here?"
Yeah.
And it's a Steadicam shot of him running down this corridor and then into the office, then around the little corner. For reasons that I've long since forgotten, we had to do maybe 20 takes of that. And at about take 18, I said to him, "Ben, I apologize for making you have to do this run every time." And he said to me, "Nonsense, I'm a trained horse." He loved doing it over and over again. And then... later that night is the shot of him on the telephone speaking over the public address system to
Love
Marty.
That shot. Amazing shot.
It was just going to be a simple shot of him on the phone. It was late. We set up the shot and John Lindley, who's the DP, said to me, "God, you can put a light and the lens anywhere on this guy and he looks great."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, let's do that." So we started adding more and more shot, different angles of him. And each time I'd give him a different thing, I'd say, "Ben, this time, just whenever you get to a line, just repeat it, if you like. It's like you're practicing it in a mirror."
Yeah.
And so he did that. It was brilliant. And we did another one. And I said, "How about this time?" And I forget what the different iteration of it was, but I gave him a different approach each time. I think one of them was, when you hear yourself say it, you realize, oh, that's not going to convince him. I know how to convince him. He kept doing it differently, and no matter what I threw at him, he was amazing. We got a close-up of his mouth. We got a shot from over his head. We just did every conceivable angle because we were having so much fun shooting him and letting him loose.
Yes.
And I swear to you, I could have cut that into a 10-minute sequence of him on the book. Just all the repetitions and Tom Ralph, who's the editor, who's very disciplined, said, "It's great, but it's gotta be tight." You do get a sense of a guy starting to kind of come apart at the seams a little bit, but he was so much fun. He's a trained horse, you know, like he can do anything and he loves doing it.
It's so funny that you say that one note, which I think is a fantastic directorial note. Just reflect that when you hear yourself say something that you're not convincing.
Right.
Because that's one of the great notes in what Tom Rolfe assembled, is that he has to change his whole intonation. It's like, "Marty." Like, it just, it like changes that next, like, "Marty." It just, like, it's it's everything, because it is that I'm going to have to say something. I'm not going to convince you if I'm just completely bluster and all violence and threats. It's going to galvanize you against me, but I have to make you remember that you're my friend. And that's special.
Yeah. He just wants his friend back.
Yes.
And in my first conversation with Ben about the role, he said to me, Cosmo, without Bishop, Cosmo is dead inside.
Yeah.
He said, Bishop is the emotional circuitry that made him feel alive when they were kids. And without him, he doesn't feel that.
This character, which we've now come to associate with him, he's kind of like a generational archetype of that now. But
totally.
I certainly remember, and like that's where, you know, where it's right at this time when I feel like JFK hits the zeitgeist in that time too. And it's like, that's absolutely where you would be a little kid and your parents are up, maybe smoking illegal substances, and they think that the kids are downstairs by themselves between the ages of 5 and 8 watching Terminator 2 Judgment Day, because there's no such thing as rating system for kids our age. And they just send us downstairs, and they're upstairs sitting on the balcony having a drink and like spouting conspiracy theories at each other. Like that, he was that guy. And they were like,
yeah,
we know that you can do this role. And I think that that's the wonderful thing about him. And I just want to quickly touch back is, especially after seeing Nothing But Trouble, when Dan Aykroyd says, I've got a way to play this character, you can imagine poor Phil Alden Robinson's wheels in his head turning, going, what does this mean?
So I think Cosmo should have a dick for a nose. What do you think, Phil? That's my take on it.
No, Dan.
No, the timing of that is really interesting, because, you know, the way that these things intersect, it you know, things are not directional or things are not direct responses.
Yes.
JFK came out in December of 91. Mm. This was released in September, in the States at least, in September of 92.
Yes.
So it's not like the character is in response to that.
Yes.
But there very much was a sense in the early 90s, and JFK was sort of the, you know, the knee plus ultra of this,
yes,
that of conspiracy theories going mainstream.
Big time.
So that I think is really is a key to the character, that, you know, it's so a part of the bloodstream now that we forget that, no, there was a time when this shit was seen as very fringe.
Yes. Very fringe. But we didn't have the internet,
right,
to create, to consolidate communities to have these conversations. It was just the one random family friend who comes to, who's staying at your house because they like travel and they don't have children, and then they just start spouting this shit, and you're like, what? And like, that's what used to happen. But now those people run Reddit forums. You know,
they do with
thousands of people, because you can.
Yeah, yeah. No, you know, back then the most they could hope was that they were on like a newsletter mailing list or something like that. But then, like, I really think in terms of like, so you've got JFK out in December 91, this comes out in September 92, and then in the spring of 93, Ivan Reitman's Dave comes out and has that great scene where Oliver Stone is like sending up his own image, where he's on a talk show saying the true thing, that this is the stand-in for the president, and everyone's laughing at him. Like, I feel like these are the three sort of cinematic key points of the beginning of conspiracy theorism really, you know, working its way into the mainstream. That's just my theory anyway. But so aside from, you know, whatever of himself he's bringing to it, it is also a wonderful performance. Like, I don't want to make it sound like he's just sort of phoning it in. His comic timing, which I think is highly underrated, I think, you know, because he's so often sharing the screen with a sort of master funny man like Belushi or Murray,
yes,
we tend to take for granted his piece of that equation, but he's a very steady scene partner. His timing is always razor sharp. He's always extremely present in the scenes. And I think the closest taste we get of that in this movie is my one of my favorite relationships in it is the byplay between him and Sidney Poitier.
Yeah,
like that is genius character comedy when you establish two, you know, polar opposites and just let them sort of grind on each other wherever whenever they're on screen together. And the idea that he's like that he is doing it deliberately, that he's like purposefully goading Sidney Poitier is like, yeah, had your boys done that yet? You know, that all of that sort of stuff is just golden.
I was just going to say, there is something so deeply underrated, and I love that you bring this up. There is something so deeply underrated about being a great harmony in comedy. Like, there are great singers who are great harmony singers.
Yep.
And there are great singers who are like lead vocalists. And the harmony of Aykroyd is always impeccable. And even then there's that great thing, and what is like the, it's almost like the punctuation that that's what's happening is watching David Strathairn's Whistler just have the biggest beaming glowing smile while Aykroyd is just needling him. He's like, what the CIA calls a Managua earthquake, and he's like, well, I can't prove it. And you just see Strathairn's smile beaming, and you're like, this is good shit. This is the good shit, right? Like, he's got that, he knows exactly what he's doing. And even just head turns, tilts, like straightforward delivery. Like, you have to be very unselfish as that guy. Yep. And I think any time that he was in this sweet spot in his career across a whole bunch of like broad comedy, you know, family genre, etc., I think he's just impeccable. And it's like, man, if he just could have just, they could have stuck him in a 10,000 of these roles, and eventually he would have been up for another best supporting actor, something. But in this, as Mother, he's like my total sweet spot because of the familiarity of that kind of archetype, but also because he's just impeccable. And, you know, he's against the best dramatic actors.
Right.
And you need a guy who can really bring it back down to the funny. And he's the guy that does that for those other
actors. He is. And as a result, you know, the ensemble here is just is so tight. Like there's in these scenes, even though there are bigger and smaller movie stars, there is a sense of camaraderie, of teamwork, of letting each other have their solos, if you will. Like, if I can continue your analogy of the harmony singer, which I think is a beautiful one.
Yes.
You know, to an even greater extent, in these group scenes, they're like, you know, a barbershop. I don't know how many of them are quintet. You know what I mean? Like, they all have to play each scene in the right kind of harmony with each other.
Yes.
And that's the kind of thing that if you can't pull that off, the whole fucking movie falls apart. And not just from a moment to moment, scene to scene perspective, which is true, but also that you have to believe the firmly established years-long relationship between all of these people.
Yes.
You have to buy that they have known each other and worked together for this long, or else the stakes of the thing and the chances that they are taking to save Martin's skin, basically, aren't going to make any sense. You have to believe that they have that kind of long-standing affection, respect, relationship with each other.
Yeah, it's that. This is a masterclass in that. Because in 30 seconds, I know all these guys.
Absolutely.
Like, in 30 seconds of the movie, you've got that. They have this first interplay. And it's just such tight storytelling and perfect characterization that you're like, every other moment after that is funny. And then even when, as you said, it's finding the gaps for the comedy, it's like, Mother's like, no, I don't want to risk it, you know, da da da. And he's like, Mother, is $150,000, it's $25,000, or it's $100,000. And he's like, I'm in. It's just the naked, like, I don't care. I'll just take the money. I want to buy a Winnebago sort of deal. That relationship.
For him, the action is the juice.
For him, the action is the juice. It sure is. Never heard that before. But I haven't in that context, but no, I think that that's where this is so perfect, and the decisions of when to deploy how these characters interact with each other and how they play off each other is so perfect. There's something so beautiful, which I'm just sort of saying to you, but as a placeholder for this moment, is like Phil Adam Robinson talked about Dan Aykroyd, David Strathairn, and River Phoenix being like the naughty boys. who would be playing, who'd be playing up and making each other, corpsing each other, making each other kill or take, laughing and just, you know, getting out of hand with each other. And I just think that naughty boy energy that he is like the ringleader of in this movie is exactly what you need, because they're all naughty boys. Like, although Sidney Poitier is like the, you know, buttoned up, stronger, like they're all a bit cheeky and they're like rascals. And so they've got this great energy. And I think that him being part of huge comedic ensembles before, he knows that there's something about the naughty boy energy between the takes that bleeds into that elsewhere. Absolutely. And the chemistry just like sings through the screen.
That naughty boy energy is part of why the Too Many Secrets reveal sequence works as beautifully as it does.
Yes, absolutely.
Like, it's almost like, you know, because they're all in the same room, but Robinson's almost intercutting two scenes there. You know, he's got Redford and Poitier and their dates over at the Scrabble table, piecing that thing together while he's got the three naughty boys at the computer playing, about to stumble on this gigantic thing. And the sheer pleasure that they experience and sort of verbalize and visualize in that sequence is why it's so thrilling to watch. And also why, again, the stakes become real, because it's like, oh, if they're this excited about this, this must actually be really fucking dangerous. And so, you know, it's playing on all of those different levels at once. And it's really beautiful. It's really beautiful.
This concludes the fifth episode of Too Many Minutes, a sneakers podcast from One Heat Minute Productions. If you want to follow everything we're doing, go to oneheatminute.com or simply follow One Heat Minute Productions wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to support us, you can go over to patreon.com/oneheatminute, and with a small donation, you get to get a whole bunch of different bonus content, get content 6 months ahead of time, and help us formulate and have a little bit of extra scratch to formulate all the amazing series we have coming up next year. Two series so far, Roman and The Mincider. Special thank you to my guests today, the excellent Priscilla Page, the excellent Lee Zachariah, and the absolutely knowledgeable and terrific and extremely well-researched film historian, Jason Bailey. Thank you, Jason. Jason's going to be joining us on a series next year on this very feed, so check that out. And also, of course, endless thanks go to co-writer and director of Sneakers, not only for Sneakers, but for his participation in the series, Mr. Phil Alden Robinson. Thank you, sir. Thank you all for listening. We'll catch you next week on another episode of Too Many Minutes.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.